So, Commissioner Beattie, questions with Mr. Welsh.
Thank you very much, Chair. So, and thank you very much for that supplementary statement. I think there's a lot in there you're inviting us to think about. If I understand what you're correctly saying is, and again, I'll go back and check, and it would be really helpful when you provide us that.
Yeah, I'll do that tomorrow. So.
No, it's all good. Totally understand. It's a plan change, it's not like a resource, because things just evolve as we go along. Don't have plan changes. What you're in essence saying is that to take advantage of the MDRS, only the council can initiate that process.
Well, there's that.
Yeah.
So yes, that's a prerequisite, but also it only relates to a relevant
residential zone.
That's a second prerequisite.
Yeah, yeah.
So council didn't, plan change 12 doesn't relate to the subject site.
Mm. And that's exactly where I'm going. So basically, in essence is, it's not a residential zone, can't rely on MDRS.
No.
And if it was to be MDRS, that would have to be initiated by the council. Yeah. I suppose in your submission, that's done by plan change 12.
Yeah, but it's not done through plan change 12 for this site.
No, exactly. No, I haven't cleared for myself. No, I understand what you're saying. And also, if I just clarify, we did have that bit of a discussion about the peacocks, and I'm learning all these things. That's really, really interesting. That was, as you, in your submission, that was, and check this with the council, that was a residential zone to begin with, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I just, last night I wrote down, the decision's online, but it said, the first paragraph says, plan change 5 seeks to replace the peacock structure plan with its general residential and special character zone with a new peacock structure plan, providing, amongst other things, a MDR zone. I think that second part is not a full accurate quote, because I was running out of space. But it's paragraph 1 of the Plan Change 5 decision. I'll provide a link and quote it in full in my written.
Thank you. Awesome. It's very helpful. Yeah. No, I think the rest of it, I mean, in essence, between you and Mr. Lang and Council for Fonterra, you've sort of inviting us to ask a number of questions about, do we have enough? Firstly, you're asking us, as collectively, you're asking us, can they rely on the MDRS? Which the answer in your submission is no.
It's no. Yep.
You're also asking us, is there sufficient detail without an economic analysis to look at the most appropriate way under Section 32?
And I say that process has been poisoned, I suppose, for want of a better word, through the misapprehension of the law.
Yes, totally.
So I say the analysis has been flawed, so you don't have that before you.
Yeah, so that's, and then following on from that is, then you're suggesting to us that we don't have the ability to rectify that because we don't have the evidence to justify, if we were to do a Section 32AA.
Well, I think your task, I don't think you're jurisdictionally barred from doing it, but I think it's an impossible task because you don't have an evidential basis.
Yes.
And I'd suggest that it's not for you to fill the gaps that the applicant has elected to not provide.
Okay, now that's very helpful. Let's just summarise what there seems to us potentially some bigger questions to ask before we even get into the more finer grained detailed questions to
Correct, and I was just going to add, and then you come through those, if you get through those hurdles, then you come to the main substantive matter, which, rather than the procedural issues, and that's around the reverse sensitivity.
Yeah. So I don't know if you could, and maybe I should have asked Mr. Lang that, and we had Mr. Titchener, and in his evidence, because I hope you don't mind, you seem to be working as a package, if that's the appropriate words to use. He talked about, I'm just trying to get the exact quote from his evidence, and he put him forward to us, let me get it wherever it was, he put to us a whole lot of impositions that would come on to him, and I assume they are because if, for argument's sake, it did get rezoned residential, those are interface controls between the residential zone and the industrial zone. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
And Mr. Holbrook provides the expert analysis of that.
That's right.
And it falls into the case law that I was referencing you to, the strata title and or the compi properties, where they say these industrial activities have established without knowledge that a residential activity could come along and have forced upon them constraints. So the bar for a reverse sensitivity can be as low as I'm an industrial activity and I could be subject to further complaints where I might not otherwise have been subject to those. But here there's actual real planning consequences through those interface provisions, as you say, Dr. Beattie.
Thank you. And that Combi case, is that the one in Takanini where they were trying to put live work units in?
I think those dreadful units that have the commercial or industrial, behind the Chartwell site, I've heard of it today, and then residential above.
Yeah, thank you. That's all for me. I just wanted to be clear. So the rest of it's clear. I just want to be my own one. Thank you, Chair.
So Commissioner Beattie has asked the question, so we've got nothing further. So to your witnesses.
Yes, so just to clarify again, these are the joint witnesses with Mr. Lang's client, but I'm in the seat, so I might as well just invite, first of all, Mr. Hall, and I understand his summary has been handed up to you.
Yes.
And I won't go through all the formalities of leading Mr. Hall. We don't seem to be doing that today, so I'll just ask Mr. Hall to commence in the summary and take any efficiency gains that we can in terms of bits that you think the panel can take as read.
Welcome, Mr. Hall.
No, thank you very much. So have you had the chance to read the full statement? I suspect maybe not.
No.
Okay, so yes, I'll...
We've read the evidence in chief, but yes. No, we haven't read the summary. So if you can take us through that.
Yeah, no problems. So I'll start with sort of the Sir Tristram Avenue and the Ken Brown Drive and sort of package those ones together. And the key issues here, sort of items 5 to 8 here, is around car parking and the effect on the neighbours. There have been some clarification provided by Mr. Balachandran and his rebuttal evidence in terms of it will be one side of Sir Tristram Avenue where parking's taking away, whereas it's both sides of Ken Brown. And despite the cross sections and design of those roads and generally traffic volumes on those roads are fairly equal if the development is to go ahead, it's not clear to me why there's a difference. And then it's also not clear what the effects are in terms of if we're taking away all this car parking, which is a not insignificant amount, what effect does it have on the existing neighbours and users of those car parking spaces? Moving on to Tarapa Road, Mr. Balachandran has provided additional clarity around raised safety platforms, and I agree that at least 4 car parks would have to be lost from the slip lane, which again compounds effects of car parking loss in addition to Sir Tristram Avenue. This is in addition to the spaces being removed on Tarapa Mainline as well, and I note that PC 13 still does not propose any mitigation or effect analysis in the reduction of parking in that area. And I'm sure on your site visit you'll see that it is very busy in terms of usage of those car parking spaces. I note that Mr. Balachandran has stated that modelling of the signalised pedestrian crossings on Tarapa Road are not necessary due to the fact that this mitigation aligns with the government policy statement on land transport. I agree that improving safety for vulnerable road users is important and that a staged crossing is likely to have a reduced effect on through traffic. However, it is my opinion that it is necessary to still understand the effects of those signals, especially in relation to queuing and whether upstream intersections would be affected. That analysis in turn would assist the panel with their decision making. Paragraph 16 in Appendix 1 of Mr. Balachandran's rebuttal statement included updated modelling of these Tarapa Road, Sir Tristram Avenue intersection. And I agree that the delays presented are now more accurate than what was in the ITA and original evidence. However, it does not appear as though the applicants have undertaken any calibration to confirm whether those delays are reflective of existing conditions. So there are still some technical queries from my perspective outstanding on that particular matter. In terms of Main Street Place, Mr. Balachandran states that Main Street Place is not a suitable location for providing access to PC 13 due to road safety reasons, capacity and directness. In terms of road safety, Mr. Balachandran states that there has been 29 crashes at the Sunshine Avenue roundabout, including one fatal crash. From my own review of the crash analysis system over the last full 5-year period from 2018 to 2022, and including all available results from 2023, only 24 crashes have been reported at that roundabout, with no fatal or serious injuries. It appears as though Mr. Balachandran has extended his review of the crash record beyond the typical 5-year analysis period, as the fatal crash identified occurred in 2017. Since that crash occurred, I note that the outer circulating lanes across the northern and southern legs of the roundabout were removed, so that there is only one lane across those legs at the intersection, reducing the overall number of conflict points between vehicles. Furthermore, in August 2018, an off-road shared path has been added adjacent to the roundabout, which means that cyclists are no longer required to share the traffic lane with other vehicles. I consider that these upgrades have improved the safety of the roundabout, and hence why no fatal or serious injuries have been reported since those upgrades were made in the last 5 years. From my review of the road safety record, 7 crashes were reported on Main Street and Sunshine Avenue between the roundabout and PC 13 over the last 5-year period. One minor injury and the remainder were property damage only. The frequency of crashes is similar to that on the Ken Brown Drive and Garnet Avenue route between PC 13 and Tarapa Road, where again 7 crashes were reported, with 3 minor injuries and the remainder property damage only. There's a slight increase in severity of crashes, but there's no significant difference in overall. In my opinion, the crash record is similar, and the concerns raised by Mr. Balachandran with increased use of Ken Drive and Garnet Route do not appear in his evidence. And I've then added a couple of figures just to show the crash record from my search as well. It is therefore my opinion that the road safety risk of connecting PC 13 to Main Street Place is no greater than other routes proposed, and that historical safety issues have been addressed. I'm still of the opinion that this route is safer than relying on right turn movements out of Sir Tristram Avenue. In terms of capacity, I note that the average delay at the Sunshine Avenue roundabout is not dissimilar to the Garnet Road intersection, which has been considered by Mr. Balachandran as not requiring any further mitigation to address those capacity constraints. It is therefore my opinion that this route should not be discounted because of capacity. I know that Mr. Balachandran states in his conclusion that having residential traffic within an industrial environment is not appropriate from a transport planning perspective. I note that Tarapa Road is also largely industrial in nature, and therefore vehicles from PC 13 would be travelling within an industrial environment regardless. The zoning surrounding PC 13 is also largely industrial in nature. It is also likely that a reasonable proportion of future residents would be travelling to work within industrial areas. I therefore do not agree that the zoning would preclude use of Main Street Place as a road in connection to PC 13 or affect how future residents travel. In terms of directness, people heading south are still likely to use Ken Brown Avenue regardless of whether a connection is at Sir Tristram Avenue or Main Street Place. For people heading north, the distance is similar for either route. Mr. Balachandran notes a difference of only 400 metres, which itself is reasonably negligible in my opinion. However, this appears to have been measured from the northeastern corner of PC 13. The difference in travel distance reduces for other parts of the site. It is therefore my opinion that the Main Street Place access option does not adversely affect directness for future residents. And then as a summary, it's my opinion that parking on Ken Brown Drive can be retained rather than parking being prohibited on both sides of the road. PC 13 does not mitigate the removal of existing on-street parking. I still have some concerns around the Sir Tristram Avenue and Tarapa Road intersection, and I'm of the opinion that Main Street Place is still an appropriate roading connection for PC 13.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Councillor Garver?
Might have to come back to me because I did have something.
Commissioner Beattie?
No, not for me. I understand what you're saying. Thank you very much.
So sorry, just for clarification, you were talking about parking on the slip lane. Is there parking on the main
Correct.
There is, isn't there?
Yeah. Yes, I can't remember the exact paragraph in my evidence in chief.
Yeah.
So I think looking at the design as proposed, I think it's about 10 spaces from the main line. It's about 5 on each side.
Yeah.
And then an additional 4 based on this additional rebuttal statement within the slip lane as well.
And if that was removed, that would then put extra pressure on...
Yeah, I mean, you're reducing the supply, yeah, exactly. And there's already a high demand.
Yeah, and it's actually quite dangerous, so... Yeah. Sorry. Don't know if there was a question in there, but...
Just on, following on, just on the theme of parking, Mr. Hall, we heard from a number of submitters this afternoon around parking behaviour, where people park, utilising the industrial area parking, the lane, notwithstanding potentially they may reside in the Main Change 13 area. I was just interested whether you had any comment around that whole issue of parking behaviour, given the industrial area and the proximity potentially to the residential area, and picking up on some of those issues that submitters raised.
Yeah, it is interesting. Obviously, the district plan has removed car parking minimums. So if PC 13 were to be zoned residential, there would be no requirement for car parking to be provided. In my experience, despite that, it is likely there's still going to be a level of parking provided. It's impossible for me to say exactly how much and similarly what those future demands on the car parking would be. So it is therefore likely that there would be an increase in demand in the wider area. The extent, I don't know.
Okay, no, thank you.
No, thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Welsh.
Yes, I'm sorry, sir, about my voice. I call Mr. Jacob, sir.
Welcome, Mr. Jacob.
Thank you, and thank you so much for the brief. That was much appreciated.
Appreciated by us also. And we have your summary statement for us, so if you'd like to take us through that.
Thank you. I'll speak to it rather than read it, if that's okay.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
So, introduction, Alex Jacob, director in ERCON, reconfirming the code of conduct. Now, I start first when we're setting up and by the way, please feel free to stop me at any point if there's a question. It's good to have a conversation about it while it's being discussed. The first point I make is when we're setting dwellings close to noise sources, our first point of interest is the sensitivity, which is protecting the people in the dwellings. Our second point of interest is the reverse sensitivity, which is protecting the people generating the noise. The reason the order is like that is if we protect the dwellings and they're happy, they're not going to complain, we'll have less reverse sensitivity. The main issue I found in the proposed PPC 13 was around nighttime noise. The reason I was concerned about it is its absence. In the 20-page assessment and the 120 paragraphs of evidence pertaining to acoustics, there was not one reference to nighttime noise. And to me, that was a bit of a red flag, because when you try to sort out a problem, you look at the critical point. And in terms of dwellings, the most sensitive time is nighttime, and we're placing dwellings right next to industries that can work at night. So that's the first flag I saw, and I thought, this is where we should start, and if we fix it at night, it automatically gets fixed in daytime. So the issues I have with PPC 13 in a bit more detail, the first one in terms of nighttime is it's not protecting from low frequency noise. I'll just clarify one thing about low frequency noise. In most plans, it's either implicit or explicit that where there's a noise source, we lower the limits in a dwellings or around dwellings, either explicitly saying at the boundary of the dwelling, it's limited to this level, or if we can't do that, we say inside, it has to be at this level. In normal dwellings, when you're talking about an area that is green fields, all of it houses, the nighttime limit, which is very low, for example, in Hamilton, it's 45 decibels over 15 minutes, that's low enough that nobody can generate enough low frequency without breaching it. So the restriction is implicit. The second point I have is around impulsive noise. That's very typical of industries where they use equipment that it's not consistent. The reason that's a problem at night is it stands out from the ambient. When people are sleeping or trying to go to sleep, there's a common noise level that they're comfortable with and it allows them to sleep. It could be higher or lower. People living in rural areas are comfortable with very low levels. People in cities or next to industries or next to businesses get used to a bit of a higher noise level. The problem with impulse is it stands out of that and it wakes people up. The way it's controlled in Hamilton, for example, is all areas that are residential have a maximum limit at the dwellings of 75 decibels. The max limit is not averaged over 15 minutes. It's whatever happens in within one short period of time. An example of it, a hammer hitting piece of steel. I put a couple of examples, or even if you're opening roller doors, the steel doors, the chains hitting the door, that'll wake people up within a range. The last concern I had in the details of the concerns is we're obfuscating a bit the nature of this zone. In my mind, a residential zone is not just we're adding a house into an area. There's an expectation around it. And people who want to live in that area, I think they would have a bit of a right to know that this is not your, for lack of a better word, your run-of-the-mill zone. It's actually a zone next to a mill, to put a bit of a context to it. Once people read it, I don't know the legalities of it. I can't comment on the legalities of it. But all I can say is it provides two separate measures. One of them is avoiding the problem. So somebody, if they feel they're sensitive to noise, they read about it, they said, look, I'm used to a rural environment, I can't deal with noise, I have kids who are young, I'm not going to live there. So we avoid a lot of the people who would not want to be exposed to this. On the other side, at the end of the process, basically the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, if they do decide to move in, there is an agreement beforehand, say, look, we told you so. So regardless of the legalities, there is an element of avoidance and mitigation associated with the no complaints covenants. And that's one of the things I was concerned about. I just want to one point about nighttime noise, just to refer to all the stuff in the Hamilton District Plan. It's covered first, depending on, I'm at point number six, flipped over to the next page. So I'm saying that residential zones or areas are protected by default in the district plan, either implicitly, for example, the 45 dBA at night over 15 minutes. It can be explicitly, like Te Awa. They have an explicit low frequency noise limit at every dwelling around them. Or sometimes when we have reverse sensitivity, an example is roads. In the Hamilton District Plan where you're dealing with the road, I'll quote the exact reference when we get to it in more detail. People are required to design their buildings with a very specific insulation, taking into account frequency of traffic. So we protect them always from nighttime noise, implicitly or explicitly. Now, I just want to note, the current assessment criteria even in the proposed plan, the 1.3.3.P.C, has no consideration for low frequency and none for impulsive noise. So when somebody is creating a resource consent,